You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Communicating Anthroposophy, the Course for Speakers to Promote the Idea of Threefolding, Collected Works, Volume 338, translated by Rory Bradley. This is Lecture 6, given in Stuttgart on February 15th, 1921, in the afternoon. It will all come down to the fact that the whole approach to the lectures that you are to offer the public is different than what lies behind almost all of the usual discussions out there currently. The approach that you will need take up will be determined above all by the fact that you always must point out the significance of the human being itself in the whole of social life. You will find social analyses everywhere now that are based on something other than the human being. You will find social analyses based on the concept of capital, the function of capital, and so on, within the social order. You will then find that capitalism is spoken of as though it were a force moving through the world. And you will find also that at the core of all this talk of, in quotes, capitalism, there is little attention paid to the essence of the human being. Furthermore, you will hear people talk about labor, about the social significance of labor. And you will be able to sense that when people speak about labor, the human being does lie somehow at the core, since the human being is the laborer. But that, as before, the concept of labor as such is detached from the human being, that is to say, from humanity, and that people are speaking about, quote, labor itself, close quote. Thirdly, you will find that people talk about commodity. This is certainly a meaningful concept within economic life, but it only leads to confusion and mistaken social concepts if we do not always pay attention to the essence of the human being. To be sure, if you start off with threefolding the social organism, you have to differentiate starkly between those spheres of human activity that must be carried out in the spiritual realm, those that must be carried out in the rights political realm, and, finally, those that must be carried out in the economic realm. But we will not correctly form these concepts, which must be grasped in such a one-sided manner regarding human activity and action, if we cannot turn our gaze toward what is essential about the human as a whole being. It is precisely this turning of the gaze toward the essence of the human as a whole being that instills in us the necessity to divide the external social order into the three spheres described in the writings that I have mentioned. Now, the human being has, in fact, been slowly removed from consideration in our modern worldview. You will find everywhere that the human being has actually been cut out. You find this, first of all, in the most narrowly spiritual realm, that of science. Science regards the kingdoms of nature, mineral kingdom, plant kingdom, animal kingdom. It observes the evolution of the animal kingdom up to the appearance of the human being, and then presents the human being as a complicated, transformed, metamorphosed animal. But it never starts by looking at the human being as such. It only presents the human being as the conclusion of animal evolution. For some time now, this has been the goal of science. But this is merely a symptom of the casting out of the essence of the human being from our feeling and thinking. If, in modern times, we had a strong feeling for what is purely human in all the various realms of life, then we would not be in a position to cast the human being out of so-called science. We would not be able to treat the human being merely as the conclusion of animal evolution. You can also see how the human being is disabled in the institutions that lie at the core of modern spiritual life. We are held fast by regulations that do not come from us, or we are tossed into the effects of forces coming from economic life. But very, very little worth is placed on the real existence of the human being as a human being in social life. And this is how people arrive at definitions of all manner of things, capital, labor, commodity. But the human being falls completely out of these considerations. In Central European countries, it is quite strange how the feeling was very recently lost for how everything comprising the state or other community exists because of human will, rather than the human being existing due to the will of the state. How all institutions arising in this community must ultimately have as their goal the development of the human being into a full human being, into a full individual, insofar as that is possible. How often have we heard repeated recently that the human being must sacrifice everything to the interests of the collective? My dear friends, if this were actually to happen, though at first it sounds quite beautiful, quote, the human being must sacrifice everything to the interests of the collective, close quote, this would only lead to a stark atrophy of communal life. Nothing would lay a better foundation for a community than having the individuals within it develop in every way and in the fullest sense of the word into unique human individuals. All those who say the opposite usually do not take the main issue into account. Those who develop into full human beings, who are able to bring their human individuality fully into being, are directed by this development of theirs to give as much as possible to the community. They lay the foundation for community in the very best way through everything that lies within them. What can be developed in a human, provided it is led and directed properly, does not therefore result in egotism. Egotism is actually generated from without, not from within. Egotism is generated primarily by the community itself. This is too little considered when it comes to social questions. And, consequently, a true misunderstanding has developed recently between the natural lack of egotism and generosity in spiritual matters, and the egotism and greed in all matters material. When it comes to everything that human beings bring forth spiritually, they are, according to their natural disposition, not at all greedy. They only want to give as much of that as possible to everyone. Someone whose inner self is a poet would like most to give away everything he or she produces, generously and not egotistically, and not hoard it. People do things differently when it comes to external material goods. They want to keep those things for themselves. But this drive never comes from within. Rather, it is created by everything that surrounds us. A truly social art would consist in taking everything that surrounds us externally and gradually transforming it in such a way that we could treat other human beings in the way that we treat those things that belong to us inwardly, what flows from our individualities. To this end, however, it is necessary that people make this way of thinking, which I have indicated now in a few abstract sentences, into their own sentiment. They will never be able to do this within the context of modern spiritual life. For present-day spiritual life tosses the human being into the external, rights political, and economic orders, and does not take as its basis the need to develop in each human being everything that flows from the individuality. In pedagogy, it is only an abstract guideline when people say that everything that is taught or used in training must be based on the human being. This abstract guideline helps nothing. And those who most often preach this guideline are, in the actual practice of teaching, for example, by and large, the ones who sin against it most. What will fill a person with a sentiment that is oriented toward the human being as such can only be anthroposophical spiritual science. This spiritual science leads us in the direction of recognizing the essence of the human being. It places the human being in the absolute center of all its considerations. Take, for example, my book titled An Outline of Esoteric Science. you could just as well use something else as a foundation too. There, the evolutionary development of the Earth is followed through its pre-earthly stages, through the Saturn stage, the Sun stage, the Moon stage, and so on. The particular names are not important. But not one of these stages has been traced in the hypotheses of modern natural science. And what has modern natural science found? First of all, there was some kind of a nebulous stage back in the impossibly distant past. There was nothing resembling a human being there. And for a long time, throughout the various evolutionary stages, according to the thinking of natural science, there was no trace of the human being. Then, one day, the human being turned up after the other beings had consolidated for a while. Some day in the future, the human being will vanish, and the Earth and everything will vanish with it. And finally, the whole of evolution progresses toward a dead and empty space. This is what science thinks about the world, about the cosmos, dehumanized. And if science were not otherwise obligated to slip the human being into this picture of the cosmos, which it is, since this two-legged animal is now walking around on Earth, and since, after all, it does manage to do this rather inconsequential thing called thinking, if it were not therefore compelled to do so, science would simply lay the human being aside, because there would really be no need to have the human being there at all. But now, consider my title outline of esoteric science from the very beginning. The human being is there. Nothing in the cosmos is considered without simultaneously considering the position of the human being within it. Considering things in relation to the human being is the only way it makes sense, and simultaneously the only way in which we have a foundation for our knowledge. The human being is never excluded. This anthroposophical, spiritual science leads our consideration of the world back to a consideration of the essence of the human being. I am touching here upon a few thoughts that will be important to you as you get ready to go out and give your lectures. They should prompt you to pursue a line of thinking that will shift the human being into the center of the social process. And I hope that you will color your talks in such a way as to shift the human being into this central position, and avoid excluding the human being from this central place. You see, the theoretical considerations of recent years have from the start left out the human being. They consider the human being only as a kind of luxury object for knowledge. Even the national economic considerations of recent times have taken a similar path. Simply go back, Marxist thought, as well as others, go back to this. Go back to Adam Smith. You will see that two things have been placed at the center of his considerations. First is economic freedom. Second, private property. The human being is nowhere to be found among these central points. The human being is incidentally a part of the considerations, but first and foremost, it is not there. The human being is not placed in the center. But of course, economic freedom is not something that the human being can have. Economic freedom is not something that you possess as a human being, but rather as the owner of some sort of property or goods. As the owner of property, you move within a set of social processes, and insofar as you own that property, you can, in a certain sense, possess the thing that Adam Smith calls freedom. But you do not market these processes as a human being. Rather, you set the property in motion. You undergo processes with the property. And these processes, the plowing and harvesting, if you own property and whatever one does in industry, these are free, independent. But the human being as such does not play a role in these considerations at all when you are speaking about economic freedom. And private property? Here we must remember that this property has to be acquired in some manner, whether through theft or conquest or inheritance or what have you. So this means that it has had something to do with human beings. But Smith does not consider the ways in which human beings develop a relationship to the things they possess. Rather, He considers private property as a kind of absolute given. This is how the human being treats all private property. The human being, too, might as well be a herd of pigs. People consider the human being as though they were not really directing the main part of their attention toward the human being as such, but rather toward the property as such. This is how national economic thinking has tossed the human being out of its considerations. But this does not come simply from what one might call a poorly developed knowledge or a lack of knowledge. Rather, this comes fundamentally from the fact that economic life itself has taken on this form. Under the influence of current abstract ways of thinking, economic life has developed automatically. The human being has progressively removed itself, has gradually given itself over to something that takes on a non-human form. You could quite easily consider this yourself in the following manner. Simply choose, shall we say, some lordly estate, and then follow its history, disregarding everything that external forces of technology brought to it during that time. Follow its history purely in regard to the human realm, which has, of course, been excluded, through a series of generations. Start with the owners at the end of the 19th century, then go back to the owners during the middle of the 19th century, then back to the beginnings of the 19th century, and so on. In so doing, you will be able to follow this history as this process is completed, as the estates get taken into the economic process. You will be able to follow it without having to pay much attention as to whether you are looking at the owners at the end of the 19th century or the beginning of the 19th century. They go for walks through their property, do the things that one would expect them to do to make their mark in the world. But it makes no difference. You cannot distinguish the owners at the end of the 19th century from the owners at the beginning of the 19th century. What you are seeing here is the non-human process at work. The objectiveness of the process has already developed to such a point that the human being is excluded from it. The human being is excluded only on one side, but this is precisely where we arrive at the current disastrous state of affairs. The human being is not excluded, however, from a certain area of spiritual life, the technological, natural, scientific realm. The human being has taken hold there, but the two things do not fit together. One has simply shoved its way into the other. The human being has also taken hold in a number of other ways, due to the fact that, as a result of the disregard of the human being, more and more people have become proletarianized. All that is proletarianized, which has no other aspect than the human being itself, all of this has come to the forefront. And thus, in recent evolution, the significance of the human being in the economic process, indeed in the whole social process, has not undergone a unified development. Instead, the individual areas have worked inorganically upon each other. One realm shoves its way into another mechanically. It would be accurate to say that nowhere and at no time has technology, for example, evolved in such a way that those who owned property were the ones who had the technology in hand. Rather, I would say, that technology pushed its way into the workings of property from the side. The result was, naturally, not something organic, but rather something that finally had to stand in stark conflict with itself. Everything that battles with itself in our time can be traced back, finally, to these facts. In your lectures, you must now bring this around from precisely the opposite side, for the effect of this is that people progressively lost sight of the connections in the economic process and directed their attention more and more toward sub-processes, for example, the way in which capital comes about and functions, or how labor plays into the national economic process, or how goods are produced and circulated. But the ability to see the connections is simply not being developed. You see, if we want to consider the unified process, the process of social life as a whole, we can do this only by placing the human being at the center, by relating everything back to the human being. The only thing that will give us the proper feeling for this is a proper spiritual science, because it always and everywhere places the human being at the center. This is why in my book titled Toward Social Renewal, I did not have to ask, quote, from which means of production did modern social life emerge, close quote. This is Marx's question, and others like him. This is the question asked by Robertus. Instead, I had to ask, quote, where did the modern proletarian come from? Where did the impulses of the modern proletarian come from? Close quote. This makes up the content of the first chapter in Toward Social Renewal. How did this important fact, that the proletarian sees all spiritual, moral, scientific, religious, and artistic life as ideology? How did this idea find its way to the proletarian? The human being is placed at the center of this. And you will find the same thing in later chapters. Only in this way do the concepts of commodity, capital, and work receive their proper meaning, just as natural scientific concepts receive their proper meaning only when we bring the human being into all of cosmic evolution. And so your lectures must be colored by this, that you have the human being at the center of all your thoughts and feelings, and also call forth in your audience the feeling that it is the human being and not capital or the commodity that matters. I would like to speak a little about precisely this nuance in your lectures. You must be familiar in a certain way with the concepts that you will find in the usual handbooks and pamphlets on national economy. You are probably familiar with them already. It is not at all difficult to be familiar with them. If you have read one, you have read them all. Just take some of the little collections that appeared in recent years, like titled The Natural and Spiritual World, or the Gerson Collection, and you will have the sense that they might as well just have given you the table of contents. If you want to become familiar with the national economy, and if you are not too weak up in the top floor but have some grasp of concepts as they have evolved, then you really do not need to distinguish between one collection and another. You can just pick one. If you want to study national economy, then take the little book from the Gerson collection, but it is not necessary that it be precisely this booklet. You could just as well pick up another collection. It makes no difference. They do not differ fundamentally in their content. It is all uniform. It is not only soldiers that are in uniforms. Even the scholarly books are all in uniforms now. The only ones where an inner life is present, or in any case an inner life in the sense that I mean here, are those collections that come from publishing houses like the Herder Buchhandlung in Freiburg, im Breisgau, for example. They are something of an older spiritual life, now noxious to the present day, is still hidden within. That is some piece of ancient Catholicism. Concepts are hidden there, that at the very least differ from the others, and have a certain inner drive, even though it is a force that drives in a direction that we do not want to go. It is ultimately the same phenomenon that you will see when you pick up a biography of Goethe that has come out in recent times. It really does not make such a difference whether you pick up one volume or another, whether it is the Heinemann or the Bilchowski or the Meyer. The authors, of course, tell the story a little differently. Heinemann writes like a schoolmaster, Bilchowski like a bad journalist, and Meyer like a collector of scribblings. I think another of them is named Gundolf. He writes a bit like, shall we say, a coquettish cultural dandy. But you will not find anything new that is not in the other biographies. Not once, I think, do you really learn anything consequentially new in Emil Ludwig's volume. But he, nevertheless, distinguishes himself substantially from the others, insofar as the others write like Philistines, who grew up indoors, whereas he writes like a street urchin. But this also does not really affect the actual foundations in a substantial way. By contrast, pick up such an inwardly stalwart book as the one written by the Jesuit Father Baumgartner about Goethe, wherein he insults Goethe and complains about him, incidentally. In this book, there is spirit, spirit indeed, leaving us with no need to wish for any inner drive. And so we can say that we must absolutely become aware of what is being produced during this present age. We must know how people are thinking about labor and capital and so on. But we must become aware that we will always have to turn the matter around and place the human being in the middle of our considerations. You might well be saying to yourself, quote, all of this could really make a person nervous. Now we are supposed to get out there and give talks and do everything that has been said here, close quote. But this is not how it is. It is a matter of having the right attitude, and not a matter of sitting here and thinking long and hard about how to bring the human being into the center. Now is the time for us to set about doing the things that have been indicated here. And consequently, the important thing is that you leave with the attitude described here, and try to do what you are able to do, according to where your development has brought you at this point. I must, all the same, present things as they would be ideally, at least according to me. And you can take from that all of the things that you are actually able to put to use. Now, if you direct everything toward the human being, if you go forth anthroposophically in this manner, if you sometimes weave into your speech what comes out of anthroposophy, then do so without bringing in so much that you make your audience dumbstruck. When you are dealing with economic life, you do not need to talk about the division of the human being into physical body, etheric body, astral body, and capital I. People cannot follow all of this these days. We have to try to put things into the language of the modern individual. So if for you anthroposophical life does not merely stand in the background, but rather is present in the way that you speak, and if what only anthroposophy can give is incorporated within your remarks, particularly if you take as examples from anthroposophy the things you use to make apparent certain aspects of the social life, then you will call forth a certain impression in your audience, and you will also be in a position to avoid any one-sided understanding of concepts. I want to give you an example of how certain concepts in contemporary social thought are being worked on one-sidedly. I have already mentioned how, for example, the Marxists speak about labor and commodities. They say that labor has congealed in the products that appear on the market. When we purchase a product that has appeared on the market, we are purchasing, quote, solidified labor, close quote. The time contained in this object is also mentioned, but this is not important here. The laborer labors. Through this process, the product comes into being, and therefore the product is, in quotes, solidified labor. The raw material offered up by nature has no effective worth in human trade. Labor flows into these materials and is thereby solidified, and establishing how much a commodity is worth is essentially a matter of seeing what quantity of work has solidified within it. The quantity of labor that has solidified there is imagined to mean an exertion or expenditure of a certain amount of brute human strength that must then be replaced. This replacement is carried out via wages. A man must be paid for his labor, so that whatever he loses through labor, whatever runs into and solidifies in the product, is replaced by the wage on the other side. This seems to be entirely plausible, if you consider the workers and their relationship to the product one-sidedly, from the perspective of physical labor. You could therefore say, considering only this particular aspect of labor, quote, a product that appears on the market is worth as much as the work that has been put into it, close quote. Certainly, this is something that from a certain perspective is indisputable, something that is strictly logical when seen from a certain angle. But now take another perspective. Take a man who, shall we say, has worked for years on generating certain products. Due to some change in economic relationships, someone on one side or another is now inclined to give more for the work that he does than he received before, because some boom or prosperous economic cycle has made it possible to give him more. He announces that he will give his labor to the person who is able to give him more money. As a result, he starts to procure more goods for his labor than he had before. This causes him to value these goods differently, to value them in a fundamentally different manner. He stops looking at things from the perspective of the commodity's value being equal to the labor that goes into it. Now the opposite perspective becomes more compelling. He starts to value goods in such a way that he says, quote, "A product is more valuable to me the more work I am spared. The less work has to be put into it, the less I actually need to work for it." Close quote. Consider the fact that it is possible to obtain goods through conditions other than labor. You can steal them. You can find them. You can obtain them through yet other means. If you consider that the words steal and find are only figurative, and the result, economically, is the same as labor, then this other way of looking at things becomes normal. If you have a commodity obtained in this manner, what does that mean for you? It means that you can give it to someone else in exchange for the execution of a task. You have done no work to acquire it, but you can give it in exchange. In our economic connections to one another, other people do work for someone else. You can have a certain number of people do a job for you. Here you have the most prominent expression of how the worth of a commodity is measured by the reduction of labor. And this reaches such a point that certain goods are created entirely under the auspices of this perspective of reducing labor, of not carrying out a job. If I paint a picture and then sell it, the economic worth of this is that I do not need to make my own brush, nor sweep my own room, nor do a variety of other things, but that I spare myself this labor. Here the measurement of worth is based on what labor one avoids. Here the labor must be measured according to the reduction of labor. And so I can say that there are two perspectives with which you can define the relationship between labor and goods, between labor and commodities, or at least with which you can define the value of that relationship. You can say that a commodity is worth as much as the labor that is put into it. You can also say, however, that a commodity is worth as much as the lack of labor in it, as much as it makes it unnecessary to put labor into it. And the first definition, which deals with solidified labor, is more applicable the more one deals with purely physical labor and its products. The other definition is more applicable the more one deals with goods in which thinking, speculation, or other valuable spiritual forces are a factor. Both of them can be applied to life as a whole, the one just as much as the other. But it is important that you not be fooled by the fact that one definition is correct in certain instances, because then you might try to contest the other. In life there are two opposing views for everything. We must therefore try not to look at life by starting with concepts. For if you have some really great and correct concept, and then you try to reach life from there, you will discover only one part of life. If, on the other hand, you take life as your starting point, then you will find that it is always possible to describe things from opposite poles. Just as you can photograph a human body from the front and from the back, from the left and from the right. Proper contemplation of knowledge really does not differ at all from the process of artistic creation. And we must replace the theoretical perspectives brought into humanity in recent years with a view toward life. But when people have a certain viewpoint, they take all of their cues from it. And people have, for the last 300, 400, 500 years, relied on perspectives that originate in concepts, and according to these perspectives, have established our social life. People create social life. As a result, we have not only one-sided imaginations of the world in our human concepts, but in life itself, we also have one-sided institutions that do not fit together or agree. For example, the proletariat has a way of working in which the relationship between labor and commodity truly is one in which the commodity represents a certain quantity of solidified labor. But if we then turn to the capitalists, we see that the essence of the commodity value is based in how much it reduces and spares one labor. As a result, we have within the real processes of social life two things that cannot be compared. The capitalists work in a different manner than the proletariat. The proletarian not only thinks but also labors in such a way that the results of the labor are valued according to the work put into them. The capitalist works in such a way that the work is valued according to the principle of labor reduction. The one must expend labor in order to generate wages. The other spares labor. And these two links intermingle and skewer each other. And in this skewering lies the social grievances of the present moment. And there is no other salvation than to see into the real underlying process, to understand life as such, and to admit to oneself that it is necessary in the social process that there be human beings. You see, here we come to the human being. Human beings who work in such a way that their labor runs into and solidifies in the product. And people who work in such a way that labor is reduced and saved. An act of labor cannot serve others unless this principle is followed. It is not possible to be a leader without following this basic principle: do less work. It follows that it is entirely impossible to integrate the regulation of labor into the economic process. Regulation of labor must happen in the social sphere, which is the right's political life. If you follow such lines of thinking, you will see where it leads. It is crucial that we clarify all concepts, since the world today is filled to the brim with unclear, nebulous concepts, even in practical areas, so that people can get things right again in their institutions as well as their thinking. If we do not have the courage to cry out to the world, quote, "You may no longer think in the way that you have up until now because you are ruining the external world with your thoughts. You must put the human being at the center of your considerations and not commodities or capital," close quote. If we do not have the courage to cry this out against the delusions of the present, then we will not get anywhere. This is to happen in those areas where people are otherwise still talking about the old imaginations of the world, particularly in the area of national economy. In the kind of presentations that I give, you see the way in which life, in all its particulars, must come under consideration. This is precisely what is not considered in the typical literature on the national economy, which is why reading any one of those little books is as good as reading any other. It makes no difference if you pick up Gerson's book on national economy or the one called The Natural and Spiritual World. In all of these books you will find what you need, along with the possibility of schooling yourself in how not to think. And in every case you will need to oppose what you find that is against a way of considering the world that deeply affects the human being, one that takes the human being as its starting point. The only way to develop this in yourself, and the only way to develop this in other people, is through something like anthroposophical spiritual science. Therefore, make no mistake, the salvation of external social life is possible only if a salvation comes about of one of the limbs of the threefold social organism, the spiritual realm, of education, development, and the like. Only if such a salvation comes about and is able to make clear the way to a productive spiritual life, one that fills the human being completely. It is difficult to make yourself understood when speaking about such things. But at the very least, those of you who are sitting here now must understand them well. You see the way in which, over and over again, the message is put out there that schools need to be formed according to the model of the Waldorf school. Some people will say, "We could develop such schools as soon as we had the money to do so." Then I always ask these people, quote, "And what would you do once you had the money?" Close quote. They answer, quote, "We would ask you which people we should hire as teachers." Close quote. I say to them, quote, I would only have a partial say in the selection of teachers, because there are regulations that only people who have passed the state exams and been approved as teachers may be hired. Close quote. This means that the results of an effort to develop Waldorf schools would not be what should result from such an effort. We first have to make it so that there is complete freedom when selecting teachers, and no barrier saying that only state-approved teachers can be hired. This requirement that only such teachers can be hired cannot be present, because otherwise we do not have a threefold society. It is not a matter of simply establishing within the present system schools in which you create surrogates of the lessons, in which you believe that you can just follow the course of study that I have laid out. Rather, it is a matter of following this one principle, free spiritual life. Only then do you create a beginning for the threefold social organism through these schools. So do not call up false imaginations in people, leading them to believe that they can carry on in their old way of doing things and still found Waldorf schools. Instead, call upon them to understand that in the school in Stuttgart a truly free spiritual life exists. There is no program there and no course of study, but only the teacher and his or her ability. Not an edict regulating how much the teacher should be able to do. We are dealing with genuine, real teachers. It is always better to have a bad but genuine teacher than a teacher who is within the regulated establishment but is not genuine. And during the lesson, we are dealing with the students and with the work that is displayed on the walls of that classroom, not with things like teaching materials or teaching methods that come from the establishment. And this is precisely what we must point out, that we should always be dealing with reality. When it comes to the program for such an institution, in my opinion, you can just get together about 12 people. It could be a few more or a few less. I assure you, if these 12 people are even a little bit disciplined, then they will be able to come up with very clever things, will be able to develop reform plans. It could be incredibly clever, incredibly reasonable what they come up with. They will be able to say, quote, this has to happen this way, this that way, and so on. Close quote. When it comes to such things, it would be right to say that there are countless people who could tell you the best way to handle a particular branch of knowledge or how to put together a journal. But this is not what we should be thinking about. It is a matter of working from the basis of reality. What is the use of having beautifully arranged school regulations and maybe even a set of teaching materials that is somewhat liberated from these things? With these sorts of regulations and prearranged materials, you just end up fooling yourself for a while, whereas you represent reality when you simply take up the material that lies before you. You have to reckon with reality and avoid such statements and programs if you really intend to create something. This is very hard for people to understand nowadays, and it is therefore necessary to make this point very strongly. By working so much with programs in every area of life during recent years, people have fundamentally contaminated life. For example, if you look at the development of social democracy from the Eisenach platform to the Gotha platform, you will see a kind of flattening. The Erfurt platform is worst of all. It prescribes the way in which everything should be organized, for example, the socialization of resources. But this is brought about through the exclusion of any consideration of life. And this was started by someone whose founding principle is something like, quote, what do I care about life? I care only about the Marxist program. Life can end as long as the Marxist program is fulfilled. As far as I am concerned, thousands and thousands of people could go to the gallows in a single day as long as the Marxist program is fulfilled. Close quote. This man is Lenin. He would be capable of sending thousands of people to the gallows daily, as long as the Marxist program was fulfilled. Of course, this is all said radically, but it is a proper characterization of the situation nonetheless. And where does this man come from? You see, the unrealistic way that this man looks at life comes from something that only individuals with genius say. Lenin is, of course, a genius, though he is a pig-headed genius, a genius that is stubborn as a bull. It is genius all the same. In his manuscript titled State and Revolution, you will find that he says something along these lines. Quote, "Of course, the fulfillment of what is to come will not follow from the Marxist program. But my Marxist program will ruin everything that is currently in place. Then a new humanity will be cultivated. It will not have a Marxist program, but will live according to this precept, each according to one's needs and abilities. But a new humanity must first be cultivated." Close quote. Our programmatic life has become so incompatible with reality that we now have an individual who, with the help of his accomplices, is establishing a vast empire not on the basis of life, but on the basis of a program professing that the very establishment of this empire is fundamentally pointless. For healthy conditions will come about only when those human beings who are currently here are no longer here, but are replaced by other human beings. I would like to suggest that in this we encounter the current state of our mental imaginations and emotional life in a very palpable way. We must not underestimate such things, but rather look them full in the face. The end of Lecture 6.